You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
Let's begin with a story, a real one that was told and retold in the corridors of an Indian university sometime in the 90s. A European observer was apparently walking through an administrative block within the campus and said later, "I have come to believe finally that there is a God, because only a superpower like that can sort the amount of paperwork I have seen lying unattended on these desks." And that brings us to the question, are we as a nation bogged down by red tape and bureaucratic inertia when it comes to education? Do we spend too much time sweating the small stuff and hence forget the big picture? Do we know how to cultivate and nurture intellectual capital? Now, each time global rankings of the best universities in the world are released, you can almost imagine the headlines the next day in Indian newspapers. Actually, you don't have to imagine them, you know them. Because as if clockwork, it is a chorus of lamentation about Indian universities not making it to the top 200 yet again. What about the IITs? What about AIIMS? The toughest exams to crack and no sign of them? The system is broken, we need an overhaul. Or the rankings are broken, they need an overhaul, etc., etc. India is the fifth most represented country on the Times Higher Education rankings last year, but there is not one institution within the top 200, which, by the way, has my alma mater, Oxford, right at the top for 3 years running now. Indian Institute of Science is the highest ranked in India, placing in the 251 to 300 cohort. IIT Indore is the highest placed IIT, well ahead of IIT Delhi, IIT Bombay, Kanpur, Madras. Reason enough for a whole host of IITians to poo-poo the rankings altogether. But that is not the question. The question we're asking today is, why do Indian universities rarely ever appear on the Times Higher Education Rankings or the QS World Rankings? Do these rankings matter, first of all? What are the systemic issues within these rankings? Is India investing enough money in the education sector, especially in research and development? Or, as Ritesh Kumar Singh, former Assistant Director of the Finance Commission of India, asked in an op-ed recently, why does a country with so much research talent produce so little homegrown innovation? Let's find out right here on Digging Deeper with Money Control with me, Rakesh Sharma.
The Deep Dive podcast series.
Why don't Indian universities feature in global rankings?
Let's start with the question, where have we let ourselves down? As Ritesh says, despite a strong engineering talent pool, low costs and a good knowledge of English, India has failed to invest properly in research and development. That working knowledge of English has held us in good stead in comparison to the Chinese, but not likely for long. As Ritesh says, and I quote, "Spending is so low by global standards that it holds back India's economic, technological and strategic ambitions. Successive governments have failed to act. A lax intellectual property regime, foolish sectoral regulations and a protectionist trade policy have for years deterred research and development, especially in the private sector. It would be comforting to think that this year's election will change everything, but government and opposition leaders alike are showing little interest. It is high time that we woke up to the challenge that India faces, overhaul regulations and nudge companies to put money into research and innovation." Unquote. As Ritesh points out, India's R&D spending amounts to 0.7% of the GDP, a fraction of China's 2.1%, let alone Japan's 3.1%. The figure has been hovering around this level, about 0.7%, for about two decades now. The bulk of the meager spending is accounted for by the government and a few strategic sectors, notably atomic energy, space and defense, according to India's official economic survey. Ritesh further says, and I quote, "When it comes to corporate R&D, India does even worse. The contribution of Indian companies, both private and public sector taken together, to total research and development is just 44% against a global average of 71%, says a recent study by the government-backed National Science and Technology Management Information System, that is NSTMIS, unquote. For private sector companies alone, he says the share is a meager 38.1%. Hence, it should be little surprise then that efforts to lift the manufacturing industry's share in GDP from around 15% have repeatedly failed. And as Ritesh says, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Make in India campaign, launched with much fanfare in 2014, Facebook profile pictures and all, has not moved the dial, nor is it likely to do so. The point we're making is simply this. The general apathy towards research as an academic pursuit percolates down from our educational institutions to other areas. And as Ritesh says, because of this, major Indian corporates tend to be inward-oriented, as selling in heavily protected domestic markets is easier than selling in intensely competitive export markets that require innovative products created by higher R&D spending. He further rues that India's lax intellectual property rights regime, especially poor enforcement and implementation, tends to discourage profit-maximizing companies in the private sector to spend on R&D. He also says, and I quote, "Moreover, the Narendra Modi government has recently adopted new protectionist rules inspired partly by US President Donald Trump. By reversing earlier moves to liberalize imports for the benefit of politically influential local rivals, New Delhi is recreating a protected environment where local companies suck profits out of captive markets without worrying about having to invest in R&D to ward off competition," unquote. The writer also hopes that this damaging legislation is withdrawn. Inward-oriented Indian companies need more incentives to compete and invest in innovation, not fewer. And as he points out, foreign multinationals are setting up global innovation centers to tap India's low-cost English-speaking engineers and technicians, and this shows there is no shortage of talent in India. The problem is with the commercial rules. Which brings us to research and development spending. Against this backdrop, most of the country's R&D spending comes from the government. But even this is often inefficiently spent. Ritesh says, and I quote, "R&D programs are often long-term in nature, but political horizons are short-term. India's constituent states compete for central government funds that are allocated more on political priority than intrinsic merit. Independent state-run research institutions that work in silos often ignore each other and the country's university research centers. A culture of awarding government contracts to the lowest bidder while neglecting questions of quality and scientific pedigree tend to discourage riskier investment proposals." Unquote. To ease the logjam, he suggests that a greater share of government R&D funds should be directed to universities, not the institutes. That will channel resources toward younger researchers brimming with energy and ideas, rather than established research programs, and adds that India must target 2% of GDP for R&D spending if it wants to be seen as an innovative country. So, the problem here is we have application, not innovation. Let us, however, get back to the point that we started with, the question about the cracks in our education system through which excellence slips and disappears. Because come to think of it, we as a nation are obsessed with percentage of marks, ranks and divisions, and the schooling of our children is an obsessive preoccupation for a majority of Indian parents. The need for academic excellence, clearing competitive exams, topping a class, all of this is ingrained into students right at home. They don't have to go to school. There are parents who already make it their most important priority. As a data story on Money Control only recently pointed out, Indian parents spend the most amount of time on their children's homework, and nearly 62% of parents in India, on an average, spend about 12 hours a week to help children with their studies. Now, those enlightening nuggets come to you courtesy of a World Economic Forum report. That can be attributed to intense competition to score better marks, and also to the pressure exerted upon students to clear entrance exams and compete for very limited seats in top institutions. Pressure gets even more concentrated because of India's increasing young population. According to the Ministry of Human Resource Development, the latest available projections currently have 55.9 crore people in India in the ages of 6 to 23 years. But the most startling question that the piece asks is whether the high percentage of the time parents spend helping their kids is because they do not have enough confidence in the country's education system. The lack of infrastructure, teachers and adequate facilities in state-run schools is an open secret. And as the piece reports, around 55% of parents with children in state-funded educational institutions said they would send their child to a fee-paying private school if they could afford it. This should cause some concern, because if the grassroots of our education system are not being nourished, how will it affect the future of the 65% of all school-going children in 20 states? That's about 113 million who are enrolled in government schools. These figures are courtesy the District Information System for Education, that is DISE data. About 6,40,000 teachers in the government schools across the country are yet to acquire the qualifications prescribed by the National Council for Teacher Education, the DISE report cited in the piece went on to say. Even more disturbing is this figure. The piece cites a rough estimation based on the government sources that there is a shortage of 30 to 40% faculty in colleges and universities at all levels. We quote from that piece, "On an average, the PTR, that is pupil-teacher ratio, stood at 21 in 2016, according to the Human Resource Development Ministry report. The report also stated that the PTR had remained unchanged for the past 5 years, indicating a shortage of teachers as India's student population has consistently grown. Cost of education in private schools remains one of the major reasons for parents' inability to send their children to private institutions. Over the last few years, media reports suggest the fees have gone up by nearly 20%. Unquote. The question that needs to be asked, though, is this. Are private fee-charging schools doing a good job? Or are they, as the piece points out, just mushrooming teaching shops? Perhaps it is the lack of confidence we have in educational institutions, both state-run and privately run, but we are a nation with a compulsive culture for tuition classes. The piece cites ASER 2017 to inform that nearly 40% of students attending government schools also opt for extra tuition classes. But we know, of course, even without looking for statistics, that even if their children are in private schools, parents tend to reach out to additional help in the form of what we commonly call extra classes or tuition classes. And yes, and that is a punishing regimen of tuition follows. As you all know, my day during high school class 12 used to start at about 5:30 in the morning and end at 8:30, not because of college, but because of tuition classes. The questions about whether the rote learning model of education works for us are relevant, as also whether governments with strident ideologies should find it easy to tweak syllabi to further their own agendas. The conflicts between the government and many universities and institutes, including Jawaharlal Nehru University, that's JNU, Aligarh Muslim University, AMU, Delhi University, FTII, etc., show that education and state interference are mutually incompatible. But that is, of course, another story for another time. Now we come to one of the central questions I started things off with, the question of rankings. Pramod K. Nair, who teaches at the University of Hyderabad, wrote a piece for The Wire in October 2018 to try and make sense of how a variety of ranking organizations work with ranking parameters and criteria, including undergraduate teaching, research, teaching, employability, industry income, and internationalization. That is, the number of foreign students coming to study in these institutions. And if the ranking that emerges from this morass of information, if at all, means anything. And as he puts it, if there is anything that we can do further to better the learning and teaching experience as we rush into the headlong halls of globalized ranking, he asks, and I quote, another question this shift into the rankings mode begs is this. How best can we recalibrate ourselves to alleviate the tensions between a quantitative ranking system and the social needs higher education has been designed for until now? Can the former enable the latter? Unquote. Can there be synergy between the ideal of educational values and the reality of market value? As he says, the former focuses on critical thinking, analytical abilities, social agendas, and the inclusion and inculcation of citizenship ideals that are unquantifiable and intangible because they manifest in our primary beneficiaries or victims, depending on how we see higher education in the long term. The market value scheme, which is industry-driven, orients the project of neoliberal higher education training towards developing particular skill sets for the labor market. Unquote. He also addresses the attack on public institutions and cites noted scholar Henry Giroux, and I quote, what we are witnessing is an attack on universities not because they are failing, but because they are public. This is not just an attack on political liberty, but also an attack on dissent, critical education, and any public institution that might exercise a democratizing influence on the nation. In this case, the autonomy of institutions such as higher education, particularly public institutions, are threatened as much by state politics as by corporate interests. How else to explain in neoliberal societies such as the US, UK, and India, the massive defunding of public institutions of higher education, the raising of tuition for students, and the closing of areas of study that do not translate immediately into profits for the corporate sector? Unquote. So when we're obsessing about global ranking systems, are we taking into account that maybe all universities need not fit into a single model of a university or abide by the same set of parameters because they have to consider where they are located and the local cultures and societies they were set up to serve? The writer worries about the alienation of the ideal of a university from the immediate requirements of the locality, region, and nation as it strives to compete with a very differently located, in terms of geography, demography, educational ecosystems, etc., of universities worldwide. As he says, and I quote, for example, if a university was set up to provide greater access to higher education for a particular region and begins to shift its emphasis towards internationalization and research, which are two key parameters in rankings, then does it serve its immediate populace better through quality classroom teaching? Would it then result in an alienation of our higher education institutions from our ecosystems because we are trying to fit into a global one? Unquote. Also, while we mourn the absence of adequate research in academia, is there enough emphasis on teaching to begin with? The piece cites a study published in March 2018 that found the following. A total of 24 ranking systems were identified and 13 eligible ranking systems were evaluated. Six of the 13 rankings are 100% focused on research performance. For those reporting weighting, 76% of the total ranks are attributed to research indicators, with 24% attributed to academic or teaching quality. Seven systems rely on reputation surveys and/or faculty and alumni awards, unquote. As the writer explains, the weightage provided for research in most ranking mechanisms has resulted in the massification of publication. We quote, India is finally an academic capital for predatory journals. Seeking to boost rankings, universities emphasize and perhaps fund research rather than teaching. Weird results have also been reported, such as attempts to inflate citation through the unethical practice of excess self-citations in the academic debate on rankings. Eventually, unless teaching becomes central to evaluative and ranking processes, the basic work of most universities in India, teaching, will collapse if it hasn't already. Teachers preparing for classes from Wikipedia is now a common feature, since student feedback on teaching quality is not factored into rankings or even for teacher evaluation. When publish or perish becomes the motto, we could perhaps ask if we publish perishable materials. Unquote. Also, ask the piece if higher education institutions that are now preoccupied with internationalization of parameters that entail the development of programs to attract foreign students can also ensure that their syllabi or pedagogies are upgraded for Indian students. As he says, nothing stops an institution from boosting its quality of teaching and research such that it impacts positively on the students' futures. His final take on the matter, standards need not come from or result in standardization. To adopt world-class standards within any domain of knowledge does not necessarily entail fitting into a global ranking mechanism. Updating and upgrading teaching materials, pedagogy and testing mechanisms, even research within the funding possibilities offered can still be world-class. Humanities and social sciences, deeply defensive in all evaluative mechanisms, are surely not quantifiable by the same indices like impact factor, H-index, etc., but that does not ever mean that we cannot publish in the world's top-ranked journals. Unquote. And he also advises that we raise standards to global levels to attract high-paying international students, which in turn will fund the regular programs of an institution. Programs that are running aground for lack of state-provided funds. I mentioned earlier also that India has become the headquarters of predatory journals, so there is the problem of plagiarism also that we need to address. Gayatri Vaidyanathan wrote on Nature, arguably the most influential and prestigious journal in the world, about an issue that has bogged down Indian academia for some time now, the one that has to deal with besmirching plagiarism. Her report is about how Indian scientists are criticizing a government proposal to pay graduate students who publish in select journals. Their fear is that it could degrade the quality of research and lead to an increase in scientific misconduct by incentivizing publishing rather than good science. We quote from that piece. Under the proposal by a central government committee, PhD students who publish in reputed international journals would receive a one-time payment of 50,000 rupees, or about $700, while students who publish in select domestic journals would earn 20,000 rupees. The cash bonuses for publishing are more than a typical graduate student's monthly stipend. The committee says their recommendations are designed to improve the value and quality of doctoral research. Various pay-to-publish schemes have been reported in other countries, such as China, South Korea, and South Africa. Indian government has yet to accept the proposal, but academics there say evidence suggests that these schemes do not improve quality of research. Some researchers want the government to fund more research and permanent jobs and reduce the funding uncertainty in existing programs before introducing cash bonuses for publications. Unquote. In 2014, says the piece, it was reported that Indian papers were cited much less frequently than papers from China or the US. The role of the UGC, that is the University Grants Commission, which is India's higher education regulatory and funding agency, has been questioned too in this respect. And as the piece says, UGC places considerable weight on the number of research publications, and so it too has created perverse incentives for scientists to publish a large number of low-value papers. No wonder then, says the piece, that papers by Indian scientists are retracted at about twice the rate of papers from the US, according to an analysis using data from Retraction Watch, a blog that tracks academic misconduct. The piece advocates, and we repeat once again, that there must be more government funding of PhD research and number of permanent positions for scientists in state-funded colleges must be increased before launching schemes to incentivize research papers. But how are we addressing the plagiarism that is so rampant in Indian academia? In September 2018, Pushkar, director of the International Center Goa, ICG Donna Paula, wrote a piece about the University Grants Commission's approval of the UGC Regulations 2018. These regulations were and are dedicated to addressing plagiarism by students, researchers and faculty at India's universities and colleges. Plagiarism is, as he puts it, along with publishing in fake journals and fabrication and falsification of research, among the major offences committed by academics worldwide. Other less known, though common, offences include the practice of adding an author's name to a paper when he or she has not contributed to the research, not acknowledging conflicts of interest, and general sloppiness in conducting research. All of which I personally have seen through my own years of research. So what is the UGC doing to curb such tendencies in India? He says, and I quote, "Slowly, the government is taking steps to address research fraud. The latest UGC regulations pertaining to plagiarism are an example of the government's intent to control research fraud. But it is important to understand that anti-plagiarism measures by themselves only attack one pillar of research fraud and must be combined with attacks on at least two others. Fake journals and of course, fabrication or falsification of research. It is also necessary to admit that the immediate impact of these anti-plagiarism measures will be minimal." Unquote. He points out that though research performance of India's universities and other academic institutions has improved, it is overall still dismal. There are many reasons for this research deficit, of which inadequate funding is an important one, but not the only factor. We quote again from that piece, "Indian academic institutions underperform in research because universities, most universities, have traditionally emphasized teaching over research. Indeed, research has been close to the bottom in terms of institutional priorities. However, with the growing popularity of world university rankings, in which India's universities perform poorly because of low research output, the government started to take notice and take measures to address the deficit." Unquote. We know that this take is different from the one we presented before on the primacy that teaching must take, but this too is a perspective that needs to be addressed. And perhaps a good balance between teaching infrastructure and research funding can move the needle towards better institutions. Just because you need to produce more research, more world-quality research in order to be considered for these world rankings does not mean that you let go of teaching altogether. And just because teaching has historically been prioritized in universities does not mean there is no place for research in these universities. The balance is what is lacking in India. Pushkar says that one of the first attempts at addressing the research deficit was the introduction of the Academic Performance Indicator, or API, in 2010. The API required all faculty members at central universities and central government-funded colleges to do research and publish, in addition to teaching and administrative duties, to benefit from the Career Advancement Scheme, or the CAS. Quoting from that piece, "Unfortunately, most state universities and colleges also adopted the API. With the widespread application of API across all kinds of academic institutions, including undergraduate institutions that are entirely teaching-focused, faculty members were left with no choice but to publish or stagnate in their positions. These included people who lacked any basic training for research and those who were already overburdened with teaching, administrative, and other responsibilities. Further, most teachers work at colleges with woeful infrastructure, and where the overall academic environment is inimical to substantive research." Unquote. The result of the nearly compulsory implementation of API, that is the Academic Performance Indicator, says Pushkar, was that many faculty members took recourse to plagiarism, publishing in fake journals or both. While for some, says the piece, plagiarizing and/or publishing in fake journals was simply a shortcut to career advancement, for most, it was a necessity. In both cases, as he says, they fed each other. Research-deficient faculty members plagiarized and published to catch up or get ahead of those who were carrying out genuine research, and at some point, the latter realized that they would be left behind if they did not do the same things as well. Many started to plagiarize, publish, and flourish. This gave birth to what is now a flourishing global industry of fake journals, headquartered in India, says Pushkar. To a great extent, he says, the current and ongoing wave of research fraud in the form of plagiarism and publishing may have started with the API, which itself was a byproduct of the growing popularity of the World University Rankings. The API was created to boost India's research output and improve the rankings of its universities. Instead, it gave a tremendous boost to fraudulent research. The API is soon to be revised, but the improved version falls short of recognizing the proper structure and complexities of India's higher education sector and will continue to be abused. Unquote. He cites an Indian Express report that exposed the fake journals industry in India. This reportedly led to an immediate response from the government, with the Higher Education Secretary R. Subramaniam issuing an order: if any substandard or predatory journals are found to be in the list recommended by the vice-chancellors, that would be held personally against the vice-chancellor concerned. Unquote. But as Pushkar says, it is a pity that neither this government nor previous ones paid much attention to reports extending over more than a decade on various kinds of academic malpractices that benefited dishonest academics and punished honest, hardworking ones. This has direct implications for the new anti-plagiarism measures that the government has put in place. Over time, says he, a large number of academics have risen up the ranks by getting away with academic fraud, and the task of restoring academic integrity is now to be placed in their hands. Quoting from that piece, to its credit, the government has in the last couple of years tried to deal with the menace of fake journals. In mid-2016, the UGC took up the difficult task of preparing a list of legitimate journals. Faculty members would have to publish only in these journals to benefit from the API. The task has so far been done rather badly. In early 2017, the UGC released a messy first list of legitimate journals that included the names of several fake journals and excluded many legitimate journals. In May 2018, it removed the names of 4,305 titles from its list, noting that these were of poor quality, provided incorrect or insufficient information about themselves, or made false claims. In the process of excluding fake journals, however, it also removed several legitimate journals from the list. The list very much remains a work in progress and will be for a while. Unquote. Plagiarism, in the end, is symptomatic of an ailing education system that needs to become, as Pushkar puts it, more than a leftover profession. Unquote. He says, and I quote, a simple research project involving re-examination of PhD dissertations submitted at some Indian universities, including the best ones, will almost certainly show that many of existing faculty members carried out substandard research and engaged in plagiarism and fabrication. Many of them are now heads of departments, principals, vice-chancellors and academic bureaucrats in positions of power. The clauses regarding detection, reporting and handling of plagiarism in the UGC regulations suggest one can't be too optimistic that they will be effective. These regulations call for the creation of a DAIP, that is Departmental Academic Integrity Panel, consisting of the head of the department as chairman and two other members, one a senior academic from outside the department, to be nominated by the head of the institution. Second, a person well-versed with anti-plagiarism tools to be nominated by the head of the department. Plagiarism cases are to be reported to the DAIP, which will also have the power to assess the level of plagiarism and recommend penalty or penalties accordingly. Can you imagine the layers of paperwork this will entail? And that is not all. As the piece informs us, the UGC regulations also call for the creation of an Institutional Academic Integrity Panel, that is IAIP, consisting of the Pro VC or Dean or Senior Academician of the institution as chairman, and three other members, all of them nominated by the Vice Chancellor, Principal or Director of the institution, a senior academic from the home institution, one member from outside the home institution, and the third, a person well-versed with the anti-plagiarism tools that I spoke about earlier. Just the sheer amount of paperwork that's going to be involved in this is already in my head, making it seem like an impossible task.
The Deep Dive podcast series.
Why don't Indian universities feature in global rankings?
How will such ideas be implemented in reality, and how effective and fast will they be in addressing a serious issue like lack of academic integrity? As Pushkar says, the fact is that the success of the anti-plagiarism regulations is contingent on how they're applied by the people who run India's universities, from vice-chancellors down to faculty members. There are all kinds of structural obstacles to making the anti-plagiarism regulations work effectively. They will be successful if, over time, Indian universities, especially research and teaching-cum-research institutions, open themselves up to hiring faculty on the basis of merit and with proper scrutiny. With the exception of a few institutions, this is not happening yet. End quote. And there we are, right where we started, at the mercy of unseen powers to help us clear the weeds of apathy before we can start planting new seeds in our education system. But a beginning, even a small one, is a good way to cleanse inertia from log-jammed systems, and hopefully we will emerge from the fog that has prevented us from seeing the full potential of our intellectual capital. Thank you for joining us.
This has been a Digging Deeper podcast, and you have been listening to Money Control.